This is Louise Bodhi, March 9th, 1992. Meaning embodied.
March 9, 1992. Louise Bodhi speaks meaning embodied. Quote from Jung is, "In the final analysis, we count for something only because of the essential we embody, and if we do not embody that, life is wasted."
Ever practice, and I'd like us all to welcome.
All these theories and these vocabularies of those words that we love to talk about, the anima, the animus, the shadow, and so on, were really just an attempt to express this essential that he was finding in himself and in others. And all of this is, of course, the process that we have come to know as individuation. Now, present-day jargon has many terms for this: self-discovery, self-fulfillment, integration, and so on. And the way of accomplishing this, I think, grows more and more refined, but I think more and more esoteric as the basis of consciousness broadens. The collective is so much more in touch with all of this than they used to. And even we who are common people, we have heard of the mysteries that only the most holy used to know about after years of devoted discipline. And we have watched what we might call the miraculous when we've watched people that we know walk across beds of hot coals. And again, that was something that used to be only the holy person after years of devotion was exposed to. And so on the more mundane level, we see self-discovery or individuation going on, both within the individual, like journal writing or meditation, in a one-to-one therapeutic relationship, or goes on in groups, and it's endless in its varieties. It can be verbal or process-oriented, can focus on the psychological as an AA, or support groups, psychodrama, dream group, focus primarily on the body and in the individual and Rolfing and rebirthing, or the body, it can focus or be carried out in groups like Stan Grof's breath work or Arne Mandel's process oriented psychology. So the list goes on and on. It can focus on the body's muscular work, or it can go through body energy work, as in Reiki. And I've only scratched the surface. Each one of you can come up with as many more of these specific kinds of work in which some way we find a way in, into the system, into that holy place, or into that essential which is within us. And tonight, I want to focus really on the body as that way in to the system. How the body directly communicates with us and brings us to this essential that Jung says we must embody. And I call this paper then the essential or meaning in body, and I'm spelling that I-N-B-O-D-I-T. And you can see there's a play on words here. I'm referring to the same essential that Jung is, but I think this is literally carried in the cells of our body, and it can communicate this directly if we learn how to listen. Now, Jung, you remember, out of his medical orientation, reached out to explore the unknown and the overlooked psyche. But I think Jungians steep in the psychic world have long overlooked the body. And this is beginning to change some. Some analysts, and myself included, recommend to some of their analysands that they have some body work. People like Dr. Bart in Zurich are using psychodrama. There have been conferences in Europe on the psyche, or the body-mind connection. They've been in Italy, Great Britain, France. There are conferences here now in this country. Analysts are writing on this. They're speaking about it. But I want to talk more directly than just talking or writing about this thing. And I want to draw on three sources. First, people who actually do body work. They work directly with this marvelous, beautiful thing that we are. I shouldn't say thing. And I want to take several examples from my own brief experience as a Reiki practitioner in the early days of my own analytic practice, and several examples from clients in my own experience receiving body work. Now, I'm not an expert on body work, or what I'm presenting, though, tonight is not complete. And tonight, I have a way of wondering and touching on a lot of subjects or a lot of pieces. And in the end, they all tie together with thread. And my hope is that simply tonight will stimulate your thinking about, yes, the body is a way in to the ascension. It speaks directly to us. And in this direct way that I'm talking about, this direct way of communication, I'm talking about the emotion, the meaning, and the experience being directly contacted. And that it is not dependent on finding the story. First, I want to look briefly at two elders in the bodywork movement. And the two elders that I would speak of are Stanley Kellerman and Marion Rosen. And the reason that I've chosen these two is because they both were deeply influenced by Jung. And then I want to change focus after talking about them briefly and see what the body can say to us directly about what I think, of course, are the three great human and universal experiences of life. And that is love and suffering and illness. And well, maybe I should just go on with the body. Because about the time that Freud and Jung were beginning their work, there was a tremendous creative upheaval among those working with the physical. And this was particularly going on in Germany, where, remember, the spas and the mineral baths, they were just a part of the daily culture. And Elsa Gindler was one of the key people then in physical, I'm not going to call it physical therapist, it was more done with massage and relaxation. We really might call her the grandmother of all that's funneled down since then. She and several others are to the whole body work movement what Jung is to analytical psychology. You know, the myriad branches off it has taken. And out of this came Fomai, Feldenkrais, Sloan, Ida Rolf, the Alexander Method, you can go on, and many of you would know this more than I. But this group was very unique because in their own individual research, they were coming to see that the body and the mind is just one interactive unit, and that the body is not an object like the surgeon sees it. But, of course, the body and mind are linked, and we reach for each of these through the other. We can affect the mind and the body by contact with the body. And let me say that again. We can affect both the mind and the body through contact with the body. So Stanley Kellerman then was one of these pioneers, and he writes of how early in his life he sought a source of authority, some reference or philosophy from which he could find values and a purpose. And he wanted some way that he said would be worthy for his own energy, and in that he included his feelings of awe and his whole curiosity about the beginning of things and the nature of existence itself. And Kellerman included a kind of energy that sought to know and to be experienced. And this is what Henry Bergson in those days was calling the élan vital. And this moved Kellerman, and also about that time, Jung's was beginning to write. And Kellerman was deeply moved by Jung's idea that the unconscious, though it is unknown, can be known. And that unconscious then is the seat of psychic energy. Now he was determined to know this energy, this élan, directly for himself. And so he began to work with his body through breathing and tracking his own muscles. And he writes that he was literally amazed at the depth of the very deep knowledge that he found in his body. And he writes that his range of experiences encompassed the past, the present. There were ideas and needs, there were thinking and feeling. There were urges to act and to wait. There were archetypal pictures and emotions. And there was inner and outer space and time. And he experienced these directly through the working of his breathing and muscles. And Kellerman, of course, began to realize that the old concepts of those early days of body and energy were very dualistic. And they were just as polarized as the even older ones of body and mind and spirit and matter. And Kellerman said that he was not a polar opposite to what his material. But he said, I am my body. And he had found his own élan vital. And how he described this was as the experiencing of himself as a somatic continuum that had a predictability and an urge to form. The old notions of body and mind were no longer any good for him because the culture had made the body inferior. Mind and feelings were less amazing. And of course, we're just beginning to come out of this. We know what he's talking about. And at that time, to even talk about body meant physiology and kinesiology, or even psychological or symbolic imagery. But he was talking about a somatic process that was almost entirely unknown. And he called this somatic reality. And he has a book by this title, which is a wonderful little book setting forth this ideas of what this all meant to him. And he said then that somatic reality is the universal forming of experience. It's the way that we connect to our history and to others, to ourselves and our personal history. And it is our bodies themselves that give rise to the impulses, the visions, to the codes, and also even the societies in which we live and that make our lives and relationships possible. And he kept talking about this biological ground, and out of it comes the meaning that we call life. But we remember that it was in 1912 that Freud said, anatomy is destiny. And our society has moved from this polar idea of this extreme quite some distance. And yet, nevertheless, one's anatomical structure, the body's limitations, and one's sexual preference, one's sexual anatomy, still spell out the destiny of one's experience. And we know how magnificent the body is in its ability to reorganize or regenerate and reshape and grow. But yet, you know, your body does shape your destiny. And we see that even though the person who is crippled may learn to climb mountains and run marathons, whether it's the stereotype of good-looking all-American, male or female, whether it's the average person that's so at home in his body that he doesn't pay any attention to it, or whether it's even the few who are so discomforted with their bodies that they undergo surgery for a sex change. Our bodies do determine our destiny. Because in each of these cases, even if the crippled person has learned to adjust and climb a mountain, think what that's done to him or her as a total being. Their destiny is shaped. And long ago it was William Blake who said, man has no body distinct from his soul. Of course, once you begin to talk about soul, you're talking about destiny. Kellerman gives us a very powerful example of Rembrandt and his self-portraits, which keep a pictorial journey of the history of his life. And Kellerman reminds us that no one before or since has created such a series of images that reveal the impact of the body's formative process and the development of emotion. And what is to be grasped in all of this is the different and many varied shapes and lifestyles that Rembrandt had in his life. And we see him as the flamboyant youth, we see him as the deeply emotional adult. We see his feminine side. We see the adventure. And finally, the frailty that he became as he neared death. And so we see through these pictures how Rembrandt reveals who he had become and how he had both formed himself and yet how his life experiences that formed him. And this is the message, this is what the body tells us directly. And in his musings, Kellerman speaks of the long body. And this body is what he calls the present history of all the bodies that we have lived through from the first egg germ implosion through the embryonic stages, on through childhood, and into the present. And he says this body keeps elongating itself throughout our life. And like Rembrandt, our lifestyle and experiences can be seen in this. In the history of our past emotional satisfactions and dissatisfactions, and they all leave their mark. And you remember this is an amazing thing if you think that we literally lose billions of our skin cells every few minutes, and that every 7 years our body is completely renewed. And you don't have cells now that you came in with or that you had when you were 6 months old. And yet, the long body, whatever that is in you because you continue to say, I am. And I wonder if this long body of biological memory isn't related to this essential that Jung speaks of. And that the essential that one gets in touch with through body work. Of course, there I'm talking only of our personal history, that long body, that which we brought in with us, the history of the race, the whole archetypal realm is in there too. But this was Telemann's way of trying to make sense of this for himself. Now, the other person that I mentioned was Marion Rosen. And she focuses more closely on the body itself as a way in to what we're calling the system, or if that seems too callous or mechanical, of the body as a way in to this magnificent essential, which Jung said we embody. She was born in Germany, and in her early years worked with Lucy Heyer. Now, Heyer was a masseuse, a dancer, and she was the wife of Gustav Heyer. And guess who he was? He was a former student and a colleague of C.G. Jung. So we begin to see here the marvelous connecting of this one world, long time back there. Lucy Heyer was also the student of Elsa Gindler, who I've mentioned, and who indeed was breaking ground in her field at that time in a way that was fully comparable to what Jung was doing in his work with the unconscious. And in those days, there was in Munich a group that the Heyers were part of. And this group was using massage and breath work and relaxation, and they were using this in conjunction with psychoanalysis, as was being practiced by Dr. Jung. They discovered something very interesting. They discovered that by synthesizing their several disciplines, the treatment for psychoanalysis would often be dramatically reduced. And people were coming to them from all over Germany for treatment. And it's strange, but somewhere back there, these two parted ways. When Heyer and Rosen went to London and did the same kind of work, the psychiatrist there had no way of dealing with this. And I think we could all pursue that in a very numerous way, but if you've got a system that is going to make your analysis shorter, well, who knows? But it was in this very rich, absolutely clinical background that Marion Rosen began her training and was in almost daily influence of the work of Jung through the Heyers and through her trips to the Tavistock lectures. Marion would leave Germany as Hitler tightened his grip and she'd come to America to continue her research and work as a physical therapist. It would be about 35 years before her work would really go public because she lacked the conviction that she had developed anything special. And what was special was that as she worked with people, following the energy that she saw in their bodies, and they began to have emotions, tension release, they would talk. And before, the analysts had always done all the talking with these. But Marion began to listen and to ask questions, always staying very simply with where they were. And when people got into the deep material, then they would refer on. But she found that her dialogue with them, these two things together, was what seemed to be making the difference. It was only about 8 years ago that really the first book on her work came out. And she she's now 75 and she's still very active in her practice and teaching. And I have some stories to tell you in just a minute about some of her work, because I think it brings home so clearly what I'm talking about when I say the body can speak to us directly. Let me give you just a bit of background about what it was that she began to discover as she worked with her clients and began to observe their process. She came to realize that the breath is really the intersection between mind and body, and it's really the most available channel to tuning in to the mind-body dialogue. And the diaphragm, that major muscle that's involved in breathing, is innervated, activated by both the voluntary and involuntary nervous system. When we sleep, of course, or when we're in kind of an unconscious state, even when we're awake, unconscious activity, the ancient part of the brain, that old, almost reptilian part, takes over and we just breathe. It just goes on. But when we need to control our breathing, like when we sing, when we run, the motor cortex allows us to voluntarily choose how we shall breathe. And we can hold it, we can increase it, we can slow it down. Now, this is old stuff for us now, but it was as brand new in Rosen's day as Jung's concept of the unconscious. And in her observations, Rosen kept wondering why people changed their breathing in an effort to control pain, because it really worked against that purpose. And of course, modern medicine knows this. Women in labor are reminded to breathe deeply and naturally, and they go through training classes and have coaches that help remind them to do this. And Rosen then saw that that muscular action is voluntary, but it is conditioned by the unconscious for the involuntary. And so breathing is both of these, voluntary and involuntary. And breathing is framed by both the conscious and the unconscious. And then here's a question or a statement that I felt had for me a kind of a numinous meaning. Because, you know, in my training, we were always talking about the archetypes and that psychoidal realm. We often wondered where it was, and it's way down in that autonomous nervous system somewhere. But she said, it's like the diaphragm is on the border between the conscious and the unconscious. And in a sense, the diaphragm is really like the membrane between the conscious and the unconscious. And with our breathing, we go from consciousness to unconscious when we ease up. Or something on a very, very deep level from the unconscious comes up and we choose to begin to breathe another way. We don't know why. And so that diaphragm is that lovely membrane almost between these. Now, here's what gets good. Rosen found that the flow of breath correlated to the muscular tension that was present, and further reading of the client's bodies reinforced her theory that muscular tensions literally form the path of the unconscious, because the muscles hold the story of the repressed emotion. So we see then that the expert can really access the emotional level of experience, that the body does speak to us directly. And it's through that which is in body, I am body, that we begin to get in touch with that essential which we do in body. And this is a very powerful experience. And these days when we hear so much, I think one has to experience this to know it. How many of you have had body work? So we could have 20, 30 stories similar to what I am going to tell you. Just two, one from my own experience in Rosenworth. The practitioner was working on my back, and suddenly, and it's hard to tell you this because I don't want to tell you about it, and I can't plunk you down in the middle of the experience, but, and I don't want to give it to you as a dream, as if I'm looking at myself. From out here, you know how sometimes you look about or at a dream. But in this experience, the first thing was that I was seeing, shapes. Later I would say they looked like tree trunks. But I simply saw shapes about this high. And they were all around me. And there came at that moment, I'm too little to take care of myself. Later, as I looked back, sure, I was about that high. I've seen all these grown-ups. I was so little. But you know, that boggled my mind, that I could know at two. I never knew that before, that I felt that. That I knew at two, and that I also knew that I knew. And that's getting to the essential. Now, another experience which I saw when Marion Rosen and one of her students, who's now full practitioner and one of her leading people, were here to give a demonstration last year. And I put some flyers about her. Marion won't be here, but there will be other workers here May 15th. When I wrote my paper, I did not know that they were coming, so I'm not selling Rosenworth. But I thought that if some of you wanted to see the demonstration, it begins to open up a bit more. Marion has the knack, I suppose, anybody experienced in body work, of picking the right person for demonstration. And as the people were coming in that night, she was watching, and she chose a very good-looking man, probably in his mid-40s, tall, with a gray barrel chest. And he agreed, yes, he could get on the table. So she simply watched his breathing, and with a very gentle hands-on, began to follow where she saw the blocks in the breathing were. And as she would move here, and there was a block, and it was free, then the energy would keep on. And she followed that. She worked in silence, didn't ask him any questions. His privacy was never invaded. We didn't know his name. There was no personal history. There was no case history. She didn't ask anything about him. And she did ask objective questions. Does that hurt? Are you comfortable? And as she worked, he began to ship, and we could hear deep sobs, even though he was on his stomach, he wasn't on his back, starting from way down in the torso. And she kept working, and then she asked if he would, before she asked him to turn on his back, she's working in the middle of his back, directly behind the heart space. And it was when she was working there that the sobs began. And she said it seemed she had a lot of pain, and there was no response, and she didn't pursue it. And then she asked him to turn on his back, and he turned over, and he taken his shirt off. And we all saw the scars of a quadruple bypass. And she said, yes, that's the heart that's felt your pain. And again, no more was said. He didn't want to talk about it. As she worked, you could see this back of his, which had been kind of like this in the back, begin to... And... absolutely, you can see it on the table. And she left him on the table after the treatment was finished. And then finally, then he took a break. And after that was over, and he was still around, see this man. And it wasn't like this on his back as much, but he literally straightened. And so see, this is what the body felt. And had she been working in a private session with him, and he had felt free, then the story behind that pain probably would have come out. And had it been on a very deep level, he would have been referred on to a verbal therapist, a person that's trained in listening more than the growth hormone. So, this lets us see that our body really does directly talk with us. Rosen learned that the unconscious material under her hands could come into awareness and into the speech of the client, not out of the cognitive brain, but out of that emotional source, the body. And I'll never forget the first time that this happened when I was doing Reiki. Many of you are familiar with that. It's a hands-on type that works with body energy. And my client, and this is not here in Seattle, and I do have the permission of this person to tell this story. She had been struggling for weeks to recall something that just kept gnawing away at her. And on the table, my hands on her back, she suddenly began to sob. And again, the sobbing comes from way down deep, so deep that it's not articulate. And it works up. But when the sobbing started so deep down, she put her hands back over the ear, like this. The sobbing came up through her stomach, into her chest, and finally into her throat, where the pain, then the experience, and the image, and then the memory and the story about all of this could be told. And the story was that when she was little, she would have terrible earache. And she would go and sit outside the door of her parents' bedroom. But they would never come and hear her. They would never help with earache. And from there, we could explore the symbolism of earache and not being heard. But what I want to really emphasize is that the body told us directly where the pain was coming from. And immediately, like me when I saw the shapes and knew something, she was back outside that bedroom door of the pain. I frequently have an analysand put his or her hands over the place that they feel tension. And sometimes that tension moves. And first it brings healing, and then the image, and the story is always last. And it bubbles up from way down in here where it's the meat, the words. And it comes up through what the ancients call the various chakras. And it comes into finally the place where it can be articulated. Now this doesn't always happen. But you can do this for yourself. And you can feel the energy within. So the experts then, through touch, can assess the emotional level of experience. And what we're touching on here, I think, is what the ancients knew. In much of the sacred literature, we hear about hands-on healing. And touch really connects to what the Hindus talk about. And they have two words, that which deals with the prana and involves the energy breath sheath around us. And the other, which deals with the mental and the emotional sheath. And of course, all of this is in what they call the subtle body. And this is described in their literature, their yogi literature. So we're beginning to reconnect with what's been there and got all covered up. Rosen has a priority of, or a hierarchy of primary emotions, and I want to go through these just very quickly. I think you'll find it interesting. And then we're going to listen to our own bodies and take some action. She said that primary emotions can be ranked from the more accessible to the deepest. And she finds anger is usually first, then sadness, then fear, and finally love. And I've often seen this progression in my own analysis. Anger and fear simply have to be cleared out before love for oneself or love for the person that we feel causes all our problems can be given a chance. And you know, it's when we do get to that place of loving that it's then we're truly vulnerable. And I think this is why there's so much anger out there today about kind of a ring of protection. Fear is often held in the neck or the top of the torso. And you know that folk wisdom bears this out because you speak of the stiff neck or the person with his nose out of joint or that little child that's got a bone in their back. She says that fear is held also in the middle of the body, but that love seems way down in the body. And she says love and relationships seem to be held at the heart level. But the really deep, total love is much lower in the body. It's way down here where the legs and the pelvis connect. It's where we allow ourselves to move or to not move. And if we love ourselves, we move. But if we don't, we're frozen. And that's where very deep love is. And essentially, the deepest fear and the deepest love are found there. That is, of course, the representation of it. Anxiety is found around the diaphragm, along with some kind of fear. But love is always the last surface. And when we really know that, kind of love. It's pure. It's not connected with anybody or anything. It's not dependent on anyone or anything. But it's the love that simply is. And even with that kind of love, until we're really grounded in it, there's a fear that is as deep as that love. Because fear is usually in response to an event and has a story with it. And almost the existential fear of death, and we get into this, small fears have to do with the death of the ego. Deep fears have to do with our own annihilation. Then that's where the deep love and the deep fear come together. And it's when we get down that deep that we know this kind of love. And this, and the possibility of moving freely with life instead of holding back, of course, that's threatening everybody. The possibility of moving out is part of this fear. But when that fear finally melts, then the struggle is gone from life.
Change focus here a bit, and I want to talk about the three things that I think the body does communicate directly to us about. Like I said, these are love, suffering, and illness. Each of these, when we experience them, put us in touch and tell us about that essential which we embody. I know that I have too much material, so I'm going to cut a bit, and I'm going to maybe focus on some of the stories. But I want to start with love. That's kind of where we ended, where we find when we finally work through and let the body really speak to us. Now, it was Jung that said, love is the dynamism that most infallibly brings the unconscious to light. And in his work on the psychology of the transference, he maintained that in the analytic relationship, the highest and the lowest aspects of human spirituality come to the fore, and that the same thing may be said in a love relationship. And so we never know when love is going to manifest or what aspect. And when we say love, we're talking about, I don't want to say levels because that implies an evaluation, but we're talking about all kinds of ways of experiencing love. And I remember when Bob Fraser, who was used to be president of the Institute for Transpersonal Psychology in California, told of how it was that he became a Sufi. And Bob had been involved in, well, he's been a searcher all of his life. He had a black belt in karate, and he had a PhD in psychology and had studied other religions. But he went to hear a Sufi master, and he said when he came around the corner to enter the hall, the Sufi master looked at him, and in that eye-to-eye contact, Bob said, I fell in love with him. And his life has been very different than it was with the black belt, than with the PhD in psychology. And so see, that too is love, the divine expression of it. So love then, one of those unexplainables, it's familiar ground to most people. We are bewitched. Our psyche is filled with the imagery of the other. And all of this we know in our psyche. But what we probably don't realize as fully is what is happening to us on this biological level that gives input to us as we find this essential which we embody. And there's a Jungian analyst in Italy who has written a book, Eros and Pathos. And he's talking about love. And his name, Aldo Cartanito, says, now it's obvious that we exist physically from the moment that we are conceived. But we only really take possession of our bodies when we meet someone who desires us. As soon as we become aware that someone lusts after us, it is a cognitive moment. From then on, one has a new and extremely important way of apprehending oneself. For when we are desired, our sense of self no longer just coincides with our personality, but actually with our carnal, our physical existence. And then he goes on to say, in being loved and desired, we become flesh in the hands of someone else. And so whoever loves me really makes possible the miracle of my incarnation. But on the other hand, to discover that one is no longer loved, it's as if one suddenly becomes invisible. For without love or even interest, the lover shows little or no awareness of the body. We do become invisible. And this is a kind of death. Now he's talking on the adult level. And yet we know from our studies that the child who is not loved by its parents, it's as if the parent takes no notice of its little body. And in a way, the little child dies. And we know what happened to the children during the war in England when they were sent away from their parents. And the real love, nobody contacted them with them, even though they were sent to safe places. What happened to them? We know what happens to children when they are not held. And so, going on, and again, Cartanuto is speaking of the adult level. In this process of incarnation, and I think that's a lovely way of talking about it, he talks about making use in a very sacred way of another human being. And then he explains this. The lover feels like an object with which the beloved may take liberties. And of course, this is a voluntary loss of one's subjectivity. And on the other hand, by desiring another, one also makes that person an object. And if we were to speak of this in psychological terms, we would talk about the object, of course, is that on which we put our projections. But I want us to stay with this process of the physical. And so a person in love experiences this basic contradiction. And it's kind of a dynamic conflict between the wish to be both the subject and the object. And this, of course, is the conflict, but it's our basic nature. And we see this in children's early exploration of each other. They want to touch and be touched. They want to know and to be known. And in that is incarnation. They're becoming little bodies aware of themselves. And of course, it's this same knowing and being known through touch that brings the warmth and the wonder to adult lovemaking. Without the experience of both of these, one becomes only an object. And we know the prevalence of this in our time. Even our vocabularies have a word for this, because we're continuously hearing about sex object and the demeaning meaning that that carries. But just as sad is the one who remains only the subject, the one who cannot allow his or her body to be the object shaped by another, and who never truly knows incarnation, can never really say, "I am flesh," with all its frailty and wonder. And I think we see the extremes of this. The one who continues to be the subject, who does not allow the body to be shaped by another. The terrible extreme of that is the rapist. But the other extreme is the impotent or the frigid, the one who stays only the object, cannot do the shaping for another. Touching, then, is a fundamental way of knowing and being known, and it's as necessary as nourishment itself. The significance of relationships lie in the unknown and the desire to touch physically and symbolically the mystery of the other and oneself. And there's a profound communication that takes place via flesh, both from person to person and also within us. And it's in the experience of love that it's the body, through its sensations, its tensions, posture, speech, informs us immediately of that essential that we embody. It informs us of our vulnerability, of our need of the beloved. And it reveals the fear that we carry, because we're no longer self-sufficient and we give up our autonomy. We know the anxiety within us, because we may be rejected. And we remember that Jung said, in love we know the lowest as well as the highest aspects. And so in love we recognize anger when we hear ourselves spewing out the harsh, dreadful sounds. We know bitterness when we hear the sarcastic and bitter tones. We recognize sadism and abuse when we abuse our soul. And it is in that that we see that evil, dark side of ourselves. And old folk wisdom again says, you can only hate the one that you love. We begin to understand what's going on here. So to love means to reveal oneself, whether it's in an erotic relationship, the parent-child relationship, friendship, or an attitude towards life. And you've heard people say, they're in love with life. It is in the experience of love that is in our bodies that we also experience the courage to risk. To risk revealing ourselves. And we can feel this courage literally, and you've all felt it. Sometimes when you dared to move, when you dared to speak, to express what the loved one had evoked. And when we do this and we are rejected, then we still are repaid with psychological knowledge that's very painful and yet is so rewarding. And Cartanuto says, love is really like an extreme borderline case where the physical and the psychological meet. Being in love has repercussions on the physical level. And this is proved, of course, when the loved one is absent, and suffering can actually make a person ill. Or we've seen the reverse of this in the timeless example, remember, of Elizabeth Barrett Browning, who was so ill and depressed and moving, moveless, that's not a word, incapacitated. And in love, she came too. So it's like love is that borderline. And it reminds me of Rosen saying the diaphragm was that lovely membrane between conscious and unconscious. And love is this borderline between health and illness. Now, I think that I'm only going to tell you, I wanted to touch a bit on suffering. Again, it's the human universal, and we don't know why there is suffering. Usually, though, it comes out of, I'm not going to say usually, a lot of times it comes out of what we do to each other. There are two kinds of suffering, psychological and physical, though they can't be separated, of course. And I'm going to talk just briefly about or about that which we get in touch with through the body. And this is betrayal, because I think that it's out of love and in love that so often we feel betrayed. It dawned on me as I was writing this paper that betrayal always involves a triangle. The betrayer, the one we love and trusts, always leaves us for the third party. And that third party can be another person, it can be money, it can be fame, adventure, work, religion, freedom, or maybe just an act done to save the betrayer's own skin. But we are left behind. We are abandoned. And it is as if the betrayer has such a deep need for that third element that he simply has to go. And yet it's in that moment of betrayal that the wound is opened in our most vulnerable spot. And that is our original trust that we had as an infant that was helpless unless it was held in the arms of another person. And I really believe that this is the primitive and basic reality of the child, of ourselves. It's so embedded in the psyche and embodied in us that we cannot dominate this. And I want to tell you briefly why I believe this is so. Remember when I told you the story of when I was two and it dawned on me I was too little to take care of myself? Well, as my Rosen work progressed, one day when I was on the table, I began to weep from that deep, deep down in place, as if from a very deep grief. And to me inside, it seemed like I'd been crying forever. But suddenly, the practitioner's hands on my back became big, strong hands. And they were held like this when you scoop up an infant. And I was so tiny that the hands kind of came up around my rib cage. And I felt this. And I felt tiny. And then all at once, my crying just stopped right in midair. And I took a deep breath and then heard myself saying softly to myself, "My father is picking me up." I was really speaking to myself, and this was the truth that my body was giving to me. First had to come the body memory of my father's strong, safe hands. Then came the articulation to myself, "My father's picking me up." Then came my understanding of the story back of all this. I remembered being told when I was a child that my grandmother was critically ill when I was about a month old, that I was often left in the care of a friend while mother went to the hospital to be with her mother. And these absences continued periodically for several months. And I'd also been told that I had more than my share of colic, which made me cry so hard that at night when my father came home from work, he would put me over his shoulder and walk and walk. And mother, whom I had barely separated from by birth, who was torn between the love for her mother and her deep love for this newborn infant daughter, she had to go. She had to make the choice. And she chose that third person. And I, in this tiny state, felt this. And I was betrayed. I was abandoned. This truth was really carried in my body, and the depth of this shocked me to think, I was so little, and I remembered my father's hands. And to some of you, you have even farther back memories than this. You can remember the birth process when you came into this world. But this is what is embodied in us. And it was the dreadfulness of the being abandoned, and it shocked me to learn of this pain. Yet with this pain also came awareness of my father's strong, loving hands, and this too was embodied in me, and I knew it at the age of 1 month. And so betrayal is part of life. We're all betrayed by our parents when they simply have to choose that third party instead of us. And most of all, we know abandonment when they choose each other for special loving. And we know that we're left out by both of the people that we love the most. And of course, how they leave it out or leave us out will either deepen or lessen that wound. But nevertheless, when the door is shut, we are left out. And this, of course, is what we know as the wound of the Oedipal triangle. And yet, I don't want us to get into jargon. I want you to feel this, that threesome, which is so necessary, but yet sets us up for being left. Now, in all of this, if we can embrace this and work with it, we come to know that the loss we really fear has already occurred. We don't have a father and mother to protect us. And we finally begin to realize that it is not the beloved or the friend who is betraying us, but I, myself. Because in betraying ourselves, we choose the third element to believe that we got left, that we were wounded, that we were hurt, instead of uniting with that essential within us that says, that's all right. Did you see what I'm talking about? And self-betrayal is the bitterest of all. Sometimes it comes when we say something and we know that's not what we want to say. Or we do something and we wake up and we realize how we've hurt another and this is not how we want to live. And we have abandoned that part of ourself, which had we listened, we would have known how to be. Now, I think loneliness is another one of those universals that the body puts us in touch with. And I'm only going to say, if you look at family pictures, often one child is standing a ways apart from the rest, even though the rest of the family may be touching. And this is the lonely child. Its body communicates its isolation, and we don't need any story to know the pain. And this kind of isolation or loneliness occurs on many levels. Many of you remember Marion Woodman's story of when she first went to India by herself. And she went over to clear her head, find out what she was going to do with the rest of her life. And the culture of India was so overwhelming, and she knew no one. There was no support. And every day she would used to go and sit in the lobby of a hotel. And she would just sit there. And the hotel, the innkeeper, began to watch her. And as he read what her body was saying, he realized the soul loneliness that she was in. So lonely that her body was beginning to retreat from this world. And he sent his wife every day to sit by Marion. And she would sit up close to her, and Marion could feel this physical presence. And this went on 2 hours a day, sometimes in the morning, sometimes in the afternoon. Day after day, a week went by, 2 weeks, and Marion began to come back. But whether it's the little child in loneliness that talks to imaginary playmates, or whether it's Marion Woodman that dropped into deep solitude so that her soul could talk and listen to itself, the body lets us know about this. And it's through that that we find that essential. I'm going to close. I'm not going to talk much about illness. There's so much we could say, and there's so much been written on this. In a couple of weeks, Tom Potler, a doctor who is shaping the use of, he calls it inviting psyche into the consultation room, into the waiting room, will be talking a lot on the relationship of mind and body in illness. I just want to say two things that illness, through our body, gets us in touch with. Sickness, when it comes, impresses one with the inevitability of death. And this comes with a vision of one's own lifeless body, and contemplating the inert deadness of death makes us realize that in and around us, on every side, is this astonishing, beautiful miracle of life. And I think that's what illness brings to us. Remember old Don Juan in Castaneda's writings in the late 60s? And he said, death's always over there over your left shoulder watching you. And you keep watching him, because when you're watching him, that's when you're really living. I remember a dream I had after seeing Amadeus. And you remember that? How many of you saw Amadeus? The scene in there where after his death he's rolled out of this wagon into the common grave. And I had a dream, and I saw myself being rolled out of the wagon into the common grave. And that really startled me. And I thought, yes, that's the psyche's gift, beginning to start me on this second half of life that Jung talks about and begin to pare down. And that was very potent, very powerful. But it's nothing like feeling in your body when you can't do what you used to do. Or you see yourself in the mirror and you wonder who that is. And this is what is embodied in us that our body brings to us to really get us in touch. And finally, the thing that where it takes us into that place when we begin to contemplate this that is sacred, whether we call it the archetypal world or the sacred world, it's really not me, my ego. It is the other, the unconscious. And Plato had a lovely story about when one sees or has an experience of pure beauty, and that would be in touch with the archetypes, then the feathers begin to sprout. And he explained that in the ancient days, the soul was seen as a feathered being. And so when we are in touch with that beautiful, rich, archetypal world, we get goosebumps. And that's the beginning of the feathers of the soul. And it causes, these kinds of experiences cause the feathers of our soul to sprout. It's in sickness that our body takes us to that realm and where we feel these sproutings of our soul. I'm going to close for sure this time. The Gnostic Gospels quote Jesus, and I don't think I have this quote with me, but he says, if you bring forth what is within you, that you will be saved. And if you do not bring forth what is within you, it will destroy you. Jesus talking out of his spiritual background. Jung tells us we embody an essential. And if we do not really embody that, life is a waste. And he's talking out of the psychological background. Marian Rosen says, let your body bring forth what is in it, and then you will be who you are. And that's out of the physical. So if we put all this together, whatever it is that's in there is our essential. And that's what we need to be in touch with. You've been so patient. Thank you. Make a comment. Yes.
Yes, I was very interested in your evacuee story, spiritual evacuee, but I saw it as incomplete. The abandonment was there, the pushing away from. And I'd rather use an analogy like a shuttlecock being hit over a net to another area. Because the other side of that is that the receiving family hated the evacuee. So the feeling of abandonment was there, and then you were received in a hateful atmosphere. You were different from them. And then you were sent back after a few months. And it was like a shuttlecock going back and forth over the net until it becomes suspended in the middle, which is, I think, an analogy for your feathers and also for the loneliness, the suspended loneliness there, which and the recovery from that after many years becomes turning that into a situation of solitude rather than loneliness. But it is this back and forth. So it's a rejection from love into a hateful situation and then a rejection from peace. I was there 4 times.
Thank you. That's very powerful. Yes, indeed. I saw one other hand, then perhaps we should close. Yes.
Yeah, I'm just speaking as a student and a therapist. A few years ago, when I was going through quite a long time of law, I went on the event manual over the course of a few years, I was in 17 sessions. And they last 60 to 90 minutes. And I often wondered, or not wondered, it just seemed at the time to put the law through. You talk a lot in the session. I kind of laughed once. I said, you must know a lot of secrets. And he said, yeah, I probably never leave Seattle alive. But I often thought that he was in a perfect position to do some very good therapy. And I noticed in your lecture at times, you said, you know, the release come up, but then somebody else would handle that situation. My question is, and I'm not aware of the certification requirements in the state or in other states or whatever, but boy, it sure seems like there'd be a real good marriage of physical therapist and mental health therapist, where at the time things would happen, you address that subject, both the law for 1 week and the law for the next week.
Well, in her work, that's what Marian Rosen has done to a limited extent. Rosen people, the psychological training is not required for their certification. They are giving some guidance in, and they stay with where the person is. They don't try to interpret. They don't get a lot into the family story. I think maybe there's two schools of thought, and I really hear what you're saying, because Rosen workers do, when it gets deep, really refer to a verbal therapist, because until we do articulate something, often we are not completely conscious. It's not out. The story's not finished. And that's such an important part of it. But I was talking with someone during the break. In my own experience, I think sometimes we don't have to know how everything happened or why. The Hindus have chants that they know clear certain chakras. And I know people who in meditation and in chanting have experienced anger by certain chants, have experienced joy, have experienced grief through other chants. They don't know why, but it's cleared, it's up, it's out. So I think maybe it's both. Long answer, but...
I just think at times, when I felt myself, I don't want to go through all of this, and going through
yes.
kind of table, and
he probably didn't feel confident, but perhaps he might have suggested that it, would you like to talk it out?
Well, at times we did. But then
I mean with someone else.
Yeah, but I think, and I was like, you know, kind of girl.
Yeah.
It seems like at times things come out, that's what it's trying to deal with the whole thing.
I really hear that in you, because it's still there. Yeah, yeah. You wished you'd had a chance to talk about it. I do. Thank you. Okay, I guess that will do us.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CGU and Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.